Hello and welcome to Eggpod Express with me, Chris Shaw. Eggpod Express takes a jaunty stroll through 1960s music magazines with a potpourri of delicious guests. To read along with us, the magazine is online at iontheeggpod.com, where you'll also find an exclusive playlist related to this particular issue. To support this podcast and to access bonus content, please subscribe to patreon.com/eggpod. And this is part two of my interview with David Quantick, and we're talking about the 14th of May edition of Disco Music Echo. Enjoy. Sometimes face humiliation while you are burning up inside. Facing reality is often hard to do. When it seems happiness is gone, you've got to learn to hide your tears and tell your heart life must go on. So we've got a story about Diane Ferraz and Nikki Scott, who are a white male singer and a black female singer, and made really great records, kind of poppy soul, quite jaunty. And it's kind of about, obviously, the issues that they faced. And that's it, really. But it's interesting, again, people I'd never heard of trying to make it. And the bizarre part of the story is that the best news they've had is that clairvoyant Morris Woodruff took them aside at a party and predicted you will be going abroad soon and be a big success. Mm. And I have to say, with all due respect to Diane Ferraz and Nikki Scott, Morris Woodruff got that wrong.
Yeah. But it's an interesting article because it says, Diane is a West Indian who gets mistaken for Millie more times than she cares to recall. Nikki couldn't be more English if he tried. He's ex-public school and comes from a whiter-than-white Stratford-on-Avon. It's the old colour bar question, and Diane and Nikki have had plenty of uninvited advice to split up. Why? Because people aren't going to like their act. It's maddening, said Nikki. One of the quality papers actually published our pictures on separate pages to avoid bringing black and white together. You can be sure our fans don't care. It's the people outside pop who are doing all the moaning. We're both sick of the subject. Why won't people let us get on with singing and leave it at that? Presumably they won't, because when questioned about any romantic link, Diane and Nikki turn coy, confess nothing and comment, "We don't confirm it and we don't deny it." So is that a case of, we're not going to confirm it because, you know, it's a white and a black woman? Or is it the old, don't tell anyone John Lennon's married kind of thing?
Yeah, it's hard. I don't really know, but it doesn't seem, well, the way things are going, it certainly wouldn't be a selling point at this point that they were going out with each other. And going to America, quite a risk of life and limb,
yes,
as well, I would have thought.
Yeah. She later went on to be in The Ferris Wheel.
Oh, right, good name.
Yeah, they're exactly as you imagine them. London-based, they're on Pie in Piccadilly.
Did they have big sleeves? There's an awful lot of bands in the late 60s have big sleeves. Diana Ferraz. She seems to be very little out there in internet world, at least on my computer.
Substitute me for him. Substitute my coat for Jim. Substitute you for my mum. At least I'll get my washing done.
Turn to page 11. When the bouncing has to stop.
Yes, at first when I saw this headline, I thought it was like a new trend, like pogoing. But it's not, is it?
No, it's written in incredibly awkward font. It's almost impossible to read, but it's basically about bouncers. Any decent diary tells you that August the 12th is the start of the grouse shooting season, but there's a far more barbaric spectacle which starts every autumn and should, as every pop star will tell you, be given as much advance warning as the grouse get. It's the bouncing season. And these are anecdotes by pop stars, some of the stuff that bouncers do at gigs, which is quite horrendous, some of it.
Again, it's like the nature of the teen magazine. You expect it to be froth, but the Mick Jagger quote is, once we were playing a ballroom day and some girl was screaming, so the bouncer just punched her in the face and cut her mouth.
Yeah.
So there's no... And it's a serious... It's always an issue. When I was a music journalist, you know, security firms were a massive issue. They were dishonest, they were, you know, violent and overly aggressive. And it's changed in what's left of live music that now, you know, there's supposed to be, at least officially, more respect for the punter. But at this point, you know, obviously the world is horrific. You've got a bunch of very dubious people with access to teenagers and no guidance on crowd control.
No. Roger Daltrey says, once I was talking to some fans when a bouncer came up and shoved them aside. I asked him what he meant by it and he said, stop being so flash, and attacked me. Then I knew that they were far too rough on the kids. And there's dozens of these. Steve Marriott, the Small Faces. There's no discrimination between the hysterical girls and those who are behaving themselves. At Northern Date, one of these clumsy, numbskulled, beefy bouncers just laid into girls who were doing nothing wrong.
Yeah, but it's, you know, it's amazing. It's great that they've done a page on this and stopped short of naming security companies and so forth, but yeah.
But you were saying that still went on in the 90s.
In the 80s and 90s, yeah, there was as a music journalist, we were more concerned about the thing of petty theft. Like, oh, you can't bring that recording device or that Walkman into the venue. You have to leave it with us. And it would, I don't know what you're talking about, mate.
Yeah.
But yeah, there were companies, which obviously I still can't name, who had bad reputations. And they've probably cleaned up their act ever since. But it was still an issue, you know, because people attending concerts were an annoyance. And at this point in history, as the article points out, they were mostly young girls.
Yes.
So you haven't even got the excuse of somebody was, you know, there was some violence at the show, or it was like the football violence of the 1970s.
But it's the side of the 60s. You don't really, you know, in these 60s, swinging 60s documentaries, you don't get really to hear on that side of things, do you?
But what you do get is what this photograph, what like the photograph here used, this sort of the amusing footage of bobbies with their helmets being knocked off by pretty girls who have lost control.
Yeah. It's not really relevant to this article at all.
No, I mean, to be honest, they'd have probably had a visit from the boys if they'd run pictures of actual bouncers.
Well, yes, of course, yeah.
Well, yeah, they've used an irrelevant photo because a photographer would probably have been beaten up if he tried to photograph some actual gig security people.
Yeah. I'm going to have a drink, sorry.
It's not that bad, is it? A large whiskey, and please.
What's that Norm Macdonald joke? I need to have glasses just to see my family. Two glasses of scotch.
Wonderful Eggpod Express.
That's the TV page. Is little glimpses into the future here.
Mm.
Because we've got a Moody Blues piece with Denny Lane, 21-year-old vocalist.
Yes.
Soon to be a member of Wings. But we've also got, and we mentioned earlier a whole scene going on, but we've got TWW's Now.
Yes.
Pop programme regrettably restricted to Welsh and West viewers. And here we see a mention of compere Mike Palin, 22-year-old ex-Oxford undergrad and Edinburgh Festival review artist.
Yeah.
So it's really nice to see Michael Palin's debut, which he hasn't really mentioned much.
Yeah, yeah. I was reading through, because I had no idea this existed, but it was after finishing university, Michael Palin, he was part of the writing team, obviously, for the Frost Report, where he worked alongside Terry Jones, John Cleese, Graham Chapman and Eric Idle. But yeah, Now, as you say, it was a pop stroke comedy show for Television Wales in the West, also known as TWW, and he continued into 1966, and apparently he interrupted his honeymoon to work on it. And the format was it had two or three bands per episode. Well, it said it's only broadcast in the TWW and border regions, but the fact it's mentioned in this issue of Disc and Echo suggests otherwise, so maybe more people have seen it, but I don't think any episodes exist.
I think that they were either went to a screening, or more likely they had somebody down there, did a write-up, since it's quite descriptive. I think Palin does mention it vaguely in his autobiography, but yeah, one nice thing about the Frost Report era was also the show with David Nobbs and Peter Tinniswood. And I was one of the compares at David Nobbs' memorial event, and Michael Palin turned up, which was really lovely.
Oh. Yeah, all 32 episodes now wiped. And
I'm surprised they were even recorded.
Well, yeah. But it was recreated by journalist Michael Well and his script writing partner Joe Steeples. And it replaced the show that was on before that, when it ran from 61 to 65, was called Discs A Go Go, which was originally filmed in Cardiff. But the problem was they couldn't get any bands to travel there, so they had to move their studios to Bristol. And famously in December 62, the Beatles made an appearance very early.
Oh, wow. I love early Beatles stuff with those terrible choruses.
Modesty.
From the immortal pages of Peter O'Donnell's comic strip, 20th Century Fox brings to the screen Modesty Blaze. Modesty Blaze, the female answer to Julius Caesar, Genghis Khan, and those others who burn cities to save civilization.
What do you want me to do?
£50,000 in diamonds.
Millions, Minister.
Millions, millions.
If I help you, you will trust me completely.
Modesty!
There's also an article on this page. In All Modesty Blaze is a great thriller, and it's the film section. This is the British spy comedies directed by Joseph Losey and produced by Joseph Chaney, loosely based on the comic strip, Peter O'Donnell comic strip, wasn't
it? Yes, I've never seen it described as a great thriller anywhere else. I mean, they're really going for it here. She certainly puts Emma Peel and Kathy Gale in the shade. Probably doesn't.
No.
I think what's hilarious, not hilarious, but what's quite funny is that while they're talking about it, it says the whole thing was reflected in BBC TV's Here It Comes Again, whole scene going last week. They are clearly wedded. I mean, you can understand why. There's a dearth of pop shows, but it's very much in tandem with that.
Yeah.
Yeah, and oh, and what whole scene going did a whole thing about strip cartoons, which is very early pop art commentary.
Mm. There is a Beatles relation to this. Music to Modesty Blaze, composed by Johnny Dankworth. Theme song Modesty was performed by David and Jonathan, who are famous for doing the cover version of the Beatles' Michelle. This was one that they released the same week that the Overlanders released it.
Ah, the big hit.
The Overlanders got to number one, sadly. David and Jonathan only got to number 11. But yeah, have you seen the film?
No, I've never seen a good review of it, so I've never seen it.
No.
Have you seen it?
I watched about half, and it was, yeah, you're better off not watching it, I think.
I feel fine with that, with the limited years left to me.
Grab your girl. Guard your gold. Hold your jewels. The fox is loose.
I will be out of here by 3 o'clock tomorrow. This I promise you.
Start the car! Start the car!
Page 13. Hollies tip the mamas and papas for the top. The Hollies are at home into London after being diverted to Gatwick due to fog. Staggered Graham, Alan, Bobby, Tony and Eric on Monday after an exhausting six-week tour of the States. One of the highlights of the group's trip was a meeting with Simon and Garfunkel and attending a recording session by the Mamas and Papas. "They're such nice people," said Graham. "We got on famously with them. Take it from me, they're going to be very big in Britain. Watch out for their LP, the one with them sitting in a bath. There's a song called I Call Your Name, which I think is terrific." And that's, very much foreshadowing the future, isn't it, this one?
It's fascinating because there's an interview with Graham Nash. So Graham, yeah, he's met the Mamas and Papas, Simon and Garfunkel, and he's brought home 10 albums by Ravi Shankar.
Yes.
And it's fascinating because obviously, as you say, Graham Nash is moving in a different direction away from the beat group pop of the Hollies. And you can see the contrasting worlds because Graham's talking about Ravi Shankar and flying to Los Angeles. Drummer Bobby Elliott says, "I've not been home to Manchester for 2 months. Suppose I'll have to do all my own washing again." So, yeah, you can see the differences. Well, you can predict the differences about to happen.
Yes.
In the two.
Yeah.
And Graham is so excited. And apart from the meeting with Peter Sellers and Burt Bacharach to talk about recording After the Fox, which, as many people will tell you, is the only good thing about the movie After the Fox, which is an atrocity, if memory serves me right. It's sort of an early attempt to do a Clouseau, in a way.
Yeah, it's a heist comedy. And it was.
But it's a nice Burt Bacharach number. Not his best, but quite good.
Yeah, well, he's talking here, isn't he? Says Graham, "We're meeting Peter Sellers and Burt Bacharach this week for talks about recording Burt's song for the film After the Fox." And it is a really good song, it's Bacharach. And it's the only problem, it's got the Hollies with Peter Sellers on it, doing that really unfunny lyric. You kind of expect, because it's Peter Sellers, it's going to be really witty responses, but it's just not.
"Why do you steal so I'll be rich? Why not work?
only good Peter Sellers contribution is on New York City Girls by Steely Span. He does a goon voice, unsurprisingly. And I think he plays the ukulele on it. That's also the album, if I'm really going to go for it, where David Bowie plays saxophone onto Know Her Is To Love Her. So there you go. There's your pop quiz sorted out for the old gentleman. Fashion now.
Page 14. Yeah, fashion. Who's wearing what? Dusty. Dusty's attitude to her clothes is exactly the same as her attitude is to singing and her personality. The keynote is individually. And we've got lots of photos of Dusty wearing various clothes.
And for me, just the names. Brown leather bag from Nita Wear. Part of a five-piece set by Slimmer Group. Darnell of London. Richard Shops. And at the bottom, just for the lads, there's some motorbike gear. It's just it's nice to see a proper fashion thing as well in the middle of it. Just obviously aimed at the girls, I'm guessing.
Well, this is very much the same remit as Rave magazine. This is what they were doing. But they were doing like page after page. But I love the fact that they've chosen Dusty because apparently she was really close friends with Penny Valentine.
And, right.
Because Penny later co-authored her biography, Dancing with Demons.
Penny was great. She was my first editor. There was a magazine called City Limits in London, a kind of Time Out political rival spin-off in the early 80s. And Penny Valentine was the music editor, and I knew nothing when I wrote for them about her background and her history. She's basically one of the first important female music journalists. She's a brilliant writer. The stuff she writes for this magazine is head and shoulders above the kind of newsy chat of the rest of it. And yeah, she was great when I worked with her.
Yeah.
20 years later.
What memories do you have of her?
Very few, just her criticising my... saying, so what exactly is this? What does four on the floor actually mean? And just, she was just really encouraging. I mean, I think I had literally written nothing. City Limits was literally the first place where I was writing reviews, I think.
Yeah.
So I was 22 and I had not done any reviewing for anybody.
Well, she was massive. Yeah, I mean, the Beatles loved her, the Stones loved her, and she was one of the first women to write about pop music, along with Maureen O'Grady in Rave as well.
It's just a fact that the women writers get written out.
Yeah.
I mean, obviously things have changed, but like there's a woman in the... I'm slightly fascinated with a writer called Julie Webb, who wrote about pop and other stuff for the NME in the 1970s. And obviously they just thought, oh, Julie, pop music. And she's completely written out. You can't find anything about her on the internet. I only found out about her when I'd go in the NME archives to research stuff. And she'd written tons of stuff.
Wow.
But you know, she wasn't Charlie Murray and she wasn't Nick Kent. She wasn't, you know, a personality writer.
Mm.
She was a good journalist. And there's hundreds and hundreds of women writers like that. So it's nice to be talking about Penny Valentine in this context.
Yes. I'm trying to get Maureen O'Grady on this because she, we talked about quite a lot in the Rave magazines, but she, apparently Penny got her the first job. I think it was on Boyfriend magazine. Maureen wasn't working. She went to Alfred Marx and they said, oh, there's a vacancy next door. She went in and apparently Penny Valentine left and she was going to be Penny's assistant. And they didn't bother replacing Penny, so suddenly she was writing all these articles, going into publishing completely by mistake, which I think most people in publishing do, to be fair.
Yes, I know that feeling. Many of Dusty's little individual dresses are made by a girl in Birmingham called June Fernilove. I love that detail. I'm going to be Googling June Fernilove after this.
Page 15, we have very similar to, it's almost kind of like the Blur Oasis releasing a single on the same time thing, because the Stones are also releasing a single, and we get some of the readers' verdicts on Paint It Black.
Yeah, and it's proper, you can't dance on your own to it, and I won't be buying it. This is why we employ rock journalists. The words are very good, so is the beat. And it's fascinating to me because you know, when you write about Paint It Black now, you people will sit there and go, like, of course, this is one of the early uses of sitar, and Brian Jones could lay his hands to anything, and here we see Jagger's classic 60s negativity, and people here are like going, I don't like it, it's too ordinary, there's nothing different about it. Any group would have done this type of record. Linda Foley, 18, typist. And one thing that we've lost, or we're losing, is the sense of being near to things. You know, when you write about the Beatles, you're writing about opinions of opinions. And we very rarely get to talk about how people felt about the Beatles at the time, or any of the groups at the time.
Yeah.
You know, watch something about punk on the telly, and it's like, everyone's a punk, apart from they work in a bank. And it's like, no, most people who bought punk records, or any records, wore normal clothes and did normal things.
Yes. There's a lot of... I'm partly responsible for this, but over-reverence to the Beatles. But I think...
There's nothing wrong with being reverent, but you kind of... One of my real bugbears is when you go on Wikipedia and similar, and it's like, reaction. And it'll be some website from 2012. It's like, I don't want to know what Pitchfork or whoever thought of some, or Music Guide thought of this record. I want to know what people said about it at the time.
Yeah.
And it's quite shocking. You get this famously Ray Davies of the Kinks reviewed Revolver and said it was crap.
Yes, yeah. I'm going to be talking about that in another episode. Like you say, yeah, so the long reviews about the seriousness and darkness of Paint It Black and the imagery. Brian Rantz, 19, says, it's not as good as Satisfaction and 19th Nervous Breakdown. It sounds monotonous. There you go. They're not all bad, but there's quite a lot here. David Williamson likes it, age 16. The words are very good. So is the beat. It's very different from their usual stuff. Very unusual, but it's great. I mean, they filled a page here, more or less, haven't they?
They filled a page here. What's also funny is it's like, again, now we're going like, oh, yeah, it's an early use of sitar. Penny Valentine says, please, someone bring back something other than a sitar.
Already, yeah.
It's 1966, and she's bored with sitars on pop records, and we can only think of three.
Yeah.
There is somebody here who says, Jeanette Newman, 16, typist, says, it does sound a bit like the Yardbirds. So they're using sitar.
Heartful of Soul.
Heartful of Soul, yeah. I mean, those 65, 66 Yardbird singles, are, you can't dance to them, but they are incredible.
Yeah. But I think there's an outtake where they did play a sitar, wasn't there?
Oh, right. Yeah, that sounds about right.
But he still plays it very sitar-like. But yeah, it's so early that they're bored of it.
That's the old, I mean, that's the golden days of pop. Nowadays, you know, take that, drop a single 5 years after the last one, and people go, oh my God, I'm not ready for this. Exactly.
With your long blonde hair and your eyes of blue, the only thing I ever get from you is sorrow.
There's an interesting here, the Merseys come of age. The Merseys were one of the few Liverpool groups who came up on the wave of the Beatle boom and who was still around to enjoy it. And their current single, Sorry.
Sorrow.
Sorry. Oh, it's my autocorrect.
The theme from Ronnie Corbett's.
Yeah, their current single, Sorrow. It's a massive jump from last week's 33 to this week's 19. But they were originally the Mersey Beats. They used to play in the Cavern along with the Beatles. But it consists of Tony Crane on vocals and lead guitar, Billy Kinsley on vocals and bass, Aaron Williams on rhythm guitar, and John Banks on drums. Basically, in 1964, Bill quit and was replaced by John Gustafsson, but then he decided to rejoin the band later that year. And then in 1966, basically the band split, but Tony and Billy continued as a duo. So, yeah, suddenly they've become this sort of David and Jonathan, Peter and Gordon affair. But it's a brilliant song. Sorrow is just an astonishingly great song.
I love Sorrow. Came to it through the Bowie version, but there we go.
Oh, yeah, same here. Pin-ups, isn't it?
It's on Pin-ups, and there's a great, if you like 60s music, and I suspect you do, when Pin-ups came out, my old colleague Roy Carr put together a compilation album called Hard Up Heroes, which is basically the original versions of some of the songs on Pin-ups, and a load of early, like, It's a Before They Were Famous album. It's got early Rod Stewart. It's got Steve Marriott's debut single. It's got, you know, tracks with members. And it's a brilliant, brilliant compilation. Sadly, on vinyl only, but you can reproduce it yourself. Well worth a look.
Oh, yes, please.
Absolutely classic.
Yeah.
But pretty sure it's got Sorrow on it.
Oh, yeah, I bet.
But yeah, it's also got The London Boys by Bowie on it, which he probably wasn't too pleased about. But yeah, it's just... And it taught me that the 70s, as someone said, were full of the 60s.
Yes.
Loads of people who'd failed in the 60s got their chance in the 70s, and there's a surprising amount of them.
Mm.
Sadly, not the Merseys, as far as I know.
No. The London Boys, it's the best thing Bowie ever did in the 60s, I think.
Oh, it's extraordinary.
A London boy, oh, a London boy, your flashy clothes are your pride and joy. A London boy, a London boy, you're crying out loud that you're a London boy. You think you've had a lot of fun, but you ain't got nothing, you're on the run. It's too late now, 'cause you're up there, boy. You've got it made with the rest of the toys.
Surprised no one's covered that one, I suppose, because it's too...
Well, he did years later, didn't he?
He did, Toy. Yeah, he's on Toy. We're digressing a bit, but yeah, some great stuff on Toy.
Yeah.
One thing I'm fascinated to be about this is, I guess because it's a weekly and bashing itself out, is the amount of repetition. So we've had vast amounts about Barry Fantoni and whole scene going on, but also Bob Lind runs through this.
Yes.
Because not only is Bob Lind mentioned, not only did Val Dunican do Elusive Butterfly and Keith Relf do Mr. Zero, but they're the opening tracks on the Bob Lind album reviewed here.
Yes. Well, Elusive Butterfly, I mean, it's a fantastic song.
It's a wonderful song.
But it's, it would have been a number one, but Val very much liked the, what they were doing, the Dionne Warwick songs. Val Dunican got his out and they both got to number five. Different weeks, obviously, but right. Yeah, it would have definitely been a number one.
Imagine saying to Bob Lind, Bob, I've got good news and bad news. Good news is your song's doing really well, but the bad news is Val Dunican's buggered your chances of a number one.
But yeah, there's a whole page of here. Lind's prettier than Dylan. It would be foolish not to compare Bob Lind with Bob Dylan. They have too much in common. But where Dylan's songs are mainly protest, Lind's are pretty.
1966 and Ain't Life Wonderlo. Modern bread for a modern world. Quick, easy, convenient. And good. Very good. Great bread, great life. Ain't life wonderlo.
New LPs. Reviewed by Mike Ledgerwood.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. Two Motown and Otis Redding reviewed together in what we may call the black section.
That's
the Everleaves, Morgan James duo, Tony Bennett, Loving Spoonful, and I mean, this is interesting because, you know, in the 90s, Q magazine would sell itself by boasting about how many albums it had reviewed in that issue. To a slightly deranged degree.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody surely ever bought a magazine going, like, oh, fantastic, 90 albums reviewed.
But yeah, that's, as you say, it is very noticeable. Yeah, and if you think the whole magazine, I think this is the first time Tamla Motown's actually been mentioned. It's a tiny little two-column piece where they've basically reviewed three albums, Marvin Gaye, Kim Weston and Otis Redding. Whereas, yeah, I'm not reading anything into it, but it's... hard not to.
I think a lot of, yeah, I mean, they review together, which is without using the word black, but...
Well, they're all a Motown, I suppose, aren't they?
Apart from Otis Redding.
Oh, no, they're not. No, they're not. Yeah, you're right.
No, he's just bummed in all the black guys. The other thing to be said is that this is, again, the album itself is not considered as important, even though we've got, you know, the Beatles and Dylan doing new things with albums. It's still the albums are just reviewed as kind of collections of songs rather than albums per se.
Yes.
So it is extraordinary to look at the roundup of the three black artists. Ain't That Peculiar, How Sweet It Is To Be Loved By You, and My Girl. You know, it's just, again, the extraordinary amount of great songs just named, briefly dropped as names.
Yeah.
And Otis Redding's early album gets less than Morgan James Duo, whoever the hell they yes. are, with their rather snazzy arrangements of Beatles songs from 200 years ago.
Yeah. Unbelievable. It doesn't even get half what they've got.
Can I just say, for the benefit of posterity, Morgan James Duo's album is called Shush, Talent Strikes Again.
I don't have it.
You don't have it? You mislaid your copy.
LP of the month, Loving Spoonful, Daydream.
A happy sound.
Yeah. And it is great. Loving Spoonful just had to happen. And everyone was so certain of the hit potential of Daydream and the way it would be, bring a breath of fresh air to the chart. Well, this album has proved them more than right. It's new, invigorating and exceptionally musical. And it is. It's a brilliant album. Daydream is obviously their second album. But it's obviously got the singles Daydream in the US. You Didn't Have to Be So Nice. And there's a brilliant song called Warm Baby, which is augmented in a similar exotic palette, kind of like Brian Jones was doing with the Stones at the time. Lovely album. Highly recommended.
Summer times for summer girls who kiss and run away. But winter girls have loving arms to warm a winter day. Warm babe, love me when the leaves turn brown. And I'll marry my warm baby when the snow is.
And you can join the Loving Spoonful fan club, Margaret, 13 Oaklands Avenue, Barrowford, Lancashire.
Yes, we've got some classified ads in here. Personal, French Pen Friends, Nationwide Bureau Arranges Introductions. That was going on back then, blimey.
Bloody hell. Girls, Ilya Kuryakin, beautifully hand-painted on silk headscarves. Fab for Shari. I'm sorry, I don't know much about paint, but I'm saying that a hand-painted headscarf would be terrible for a showery day.
I think so.
They haven't thought it through. Also, here we go. Tape recorders, it's a tape sponding. So basically, people are, I'm guessing, buying tapes recorders, enormous reel-to-reels, and sending recorded messages around the world, possibly.
Yes, I've got a recording of my wife's grandparents and parents from 1963, because a lot of them moved to Australia, which many people did at the time. And they sent one from the UK to send to them in Australia. And it's fascinating stuff. But I think that must have been through this, because, we found the reel-to-reel, got it converted. And it's... You know, people in the 60s had different accents. They're all from Kent, but it's like this really weird Harry Enfield kind of accents. And it's just weird hearing people that you... I knew my wife's father, and he didn't speak like that when I knew him, but back in the 60s, he had exactly the Harry Enfield thing. But yeah, tape sponders. Interesting.
Hello, Pat. It's the old man speaking. Still living at Grey Farm. Still keep on dodging about. But we're living now on what they call the old age pension, state pension, and we're still lingering along. How's Tony? What used to sneak up round the old garden, have a look at me. Tell him we got no dogs now on the old Peter, he's a new one. Well, I ain't got much to say now, because I've got to get away and get some old ale. Would you like a drop? Long way to send it, but still. You can fancy you're drinking it. So long, the old man.
Page 17, Pop Post. This is the letters page. More love for the Loving Spoonful.
No mentions of Barry Fantoni or the whole thing going on, but classic pop letters page, because almost every letter is stop knocking someone. Stop knocking David Jacobs. Why doesn't Paul Jones keep his mouth shut? Stop knocking Cliff Richard. And my favourite letter of all time may be here. From Mrs. Beryl Drew of Luton, why hasn't there been a record by the late Jim Reeves for nearly 6 months? You think he's all right? Do you know what she means?
Yeah.
You think? Because he's dead. dear. Sorry, Jim. Sorry, Barrel Crew.
Oh God, sorry. What was she thinking? I don't know what she means.
She does make a point, because she does go on to say, in the States of South Africa, his records are released at a steady flow.
Yeah.
Yeah, there were posthumous stars, but...
Well, he died in... sorry, I can't... It's got a photo of him as well. Well... Because he died at the end in July 1964, so we're now in April 66. And I know when he was alive, he would do... Like, he'd go into the studio and he would just record one after the other after the other, so there was a certain backlog. It's the fact that she says, why hasn't there been a record by the late Jim Reeves?
I suppose when she was writing it, she could have thought, why hasn't there been a record by Jim Reeves for 6 months? And she thought, everyone's going to go because he's dead. So I'll preempt them by saying, why hasn't there been a letter record? I mean, we're assuming, by the way, that there's a real person called Beryl Drew. I used to make up letters for the Enemy Letters page because there simply weren't enough, and there simply weren't enough of any quality.
Oh, okay.
So, but mostly it was filling up the page.
Can you remember any of the ones that you made up?
Oh, yeah, I can remember causing a great deal of outrage because one fanzine writer, editor, wrote to the Enemy and I didn't like his tone. So I left his letter alone. Well, I changed the name of his fanzine to, I forget what it was called, I changed the name of fanzine to Wanker Magazine, which is a thick something that only he would have noticed. And he did. He wrote back. So I did it again.
There's another section on here called Last Words, and these are essentially tweets. They're very brief, literally one sentence. Jonathan King and John Mouth should be shot. Frankie Taylor, Paisley. Jonathan King's current anti-Stones crusade is enough to make anybody vomit. John Sharp, Gloucester. Interesting to see Jonathan King doing his attention-seeking controversy even back then.
Yeah, because we haven't really mentioned. Because he has a... Well, we can talk about it. He has a column which is basically knee-jerk reactions to everything that's good he says is crap.
Yeah.
And vice versa. But you're exactly right about the tweet thing. Mick Jagger prances about on stage like a mad ape. Linda and Carol. It took two of them to write this.
Stones could do with a few singing lessons from the Walkers. Two Walkers fans, Newcastle. And then there's a lovely one. Please, please, will everyone stop knocking David Jacobs? I think he's lovely.
He always was lovely.
Yes.
He doesn't try to be clever or funny. That's the kind of review you want.
Yeah.
Reading between the lines. You stupid,
dull.
Dumb, funny. Stupid and dull.
That's from Elizabeth Wayne.
Thank you, Elizabeth.
Direct from the Cavern Club in the heart of Liverpool, the greatest beat music basement in the world, this is Bob Wooler, inviting you to join the hundreds of enthusiastic teenagers at this live recording session. For our big beat rave at the Cavern tonight, we've got three great new wave attractions who right now are taking Liverpool by storm. And here, in person, to get this show really swinging, is the exciting Earl Preston's Realm.
Page 18, we have a couple of articles. There's one interesting on the right-hand side, Mersey News. And basically, originally Bill Harry's Mersey Beat magazine was so popular that in September 64, Brian Epstein approached him to create a national music paper. And it was Bill who came up with the name Music Echo and gradually merged it with Mersey Beat. Although Brian had offered Bill full editorial control, he hired a press officer and DJ to write fashion and gossip columns, and he did this behind Bill's back. So Bill was so furious he resigned, and the magazine soon ran into financial problems. So Brian had no option other than to merge it with Disc magazine, and hence why this is Disc and Music Echo. So now, from what was Mersey Beat, there's just a tiny little column near the back of the magazine, and it kind of says also more about Merseybeat, the music, doesn't it, I guess?
Yeah, it's really weird. It's just like a lost island. It's like a Japanese soldier in the jungle, because there is no Merseybeat at this point in history. Even one of the stories opens up with, it's like old times, jazz at the Mardi Gras. And there's a concert with Bob Woodward. Says this is the first locally presented concert since the Beatles show in October 1962. So they're really running out of things. And it just looks weird. Why are they focusing on Liverpool? And we know why, obviously, but hottest property on Merseyside is 18-year-old potster Tiffany. Yeah. Irene Caldwell. I'm thinking of Minnie Caldwell from Coronation Street.
No.
So when you think the name's familiar, but it's not. And it's like, everyone's getting married in Liverpool. Fix singer Eddie Kay married, don't know who they are. The Realm, don't know who they are.
Oh, Earl Preston in the Realms, yeah.
The Excels, just the Hideaways.
Yeah.
Just, we don't know who they are.
Well, a lot of these I recognise because previously I did the Beatles Top Poll issue of Merseybeat with Mark Lewis. And so a lot of these bands are in here, or they later went on to be in these bands, but it's still the same people who were playing at the Cavern 4 years earlier, really.
The Cavern is going into this reopening in mid-July.
Oh, yeah. They've done it up, haven't they?
It's coincided with the anticipated invasion of overseas visitors for the World Cup.
Yes, that's not started yet, has it? Wow.
No, we're about to have Revolver and the World Cup. It's going to be the most triumphant year for Carnaby Street version of Britain ever.
Yeah. And on the left-hand column, we have Name Game by Rod Harrod. This is a column by Rod Harrod, who, as well as being a journalist for the magazine, was also the host of the Scotch of St. James Club in London.
Oh, wow.
And he's best remembered for being the one who offered Jimi Hendrix his first gig in the UK. And it was at Rod's club that Jimmy's heads of agreement were drafted on napkin between Jimmy's co-manager, Chas Chandler, and future owners of Track Records, Kit Lattimore.
Fantastic. So he knows what he's talking about.
Yeah. But he's got Goldie. It says, Goldie's luck holds, Dylan gets sacked, Spencer Beatnik. And there's the first one here. Not only business managers tell American girl pop singers what to do, a fortune teller in London's Oxford Street has placed a big part in several girls' lives. It started with Doris Troy. She saw the fortune teller and was told to go back to America, where she would be more successful than here. Doris told Carol and Margot, who used to form part of the Gingerbreads, so they saw the fortune teller and were told the same, to go back to New York and reform the group. And in fact, Doris would only have success 3 years later when she moved back to London. And obviously George Harrison signed her to Apple.
Yeah, I don't really know, but does seem to be quite a lazy fortune teller, really. Or maybe a fortune teller who basically was really good and said, essentially, your blend of R&B, pop and gospel is slightly outdated for the English market. However, if you return to America, it'll be a kind of Coles to Newcastle situation.
Yeah.
But it's probably more likely she just told everybody to go back to America and have a hit there. Confusing many, many people.
Yeah.
It's nice to see there's a story about Bob Dylan and Bobby V. Again, this kind of thing that the historians like. You know, even now, not many people know that Bob Dylan started off playing piano for the rubber ball hit maker, Bobby V. It's not a very interesting story. Bobby V said, basically tells him that he's not very good.
Yes.
The end.
Yeah, he was looking for a pianist as a last resort, took on Dylan. Bobby gained national acclaim shortly after the death of Buddy Holly. Dates started to roll in and he could pick and choose the musicians. So one day he sacked Dylan, telling him, I don't know whether you'll ever make the grade on your own, son, but not with my band.
And it's like, well, to be honest, no one's ever, even now, no one's ever hired Bob Dylan for his piano playing skills. Who do we need to play piano on this? I know, Bob Dylan. He'll be great.
My soul and my heart, inspiration.
There's a, yeah, one of these articles, Spectre. The Righteous Brothers were pretty mad with their former record producer, Phil Spector, at the time of their split. So, when asked by the record company what they were going to record, they said Soul and Inspiration. They chose it so they could give it a treatment as close to the Spectre sound as possible to prove to Phil that other people could do it as well. And I didn't realise this. It's I love this song so much, but it's produced by Bill Medley and arranged by Jack Meach. I always thought it was a Spectre. But it's still got several members of the Wrecking Crew. But yeah, you'd never know it wasn't a Spectre production. So it's basically saying, up yours, Phil Spectre.
I always found Bill Medley confusing just because whenever I used to read songwriting credits, I used to think, that's not a medley. I noticed, by the way, sorry, just looking, going back to the Merseybeat thing, the Hideaways, whoever they are, hope to go to Rome in June. On the way back, they'll do dates in Paris. And singer Judd Lander plans to work on tapes. Judd Lander, of course, famous for being an A&R man later, but more famous for playing harmonica on Karma Chameleon by Culture Club.
Yes, yeah. There's an interview online with Mark Lewisohn as well at last year's Beatles Fest.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Oh, he's great.
Some people always keep turning up throughout history. Especially in popular music.
Talking of which, Jonathan King column and his bit of controversial insight is the sitar is one of the least attractive noises heard in 1966.
We won't be hearing that again. Goodbye, sitar. No way will sitar has become an important part of popular music and Western culture. But he does predict accurately, of course, the return of the Buddy Holly style, which was so important in 1967. Bands such as Pink Floyd and the Pretty Things embrace the Buddy. No, of course not.
Yeah, I've got a story about Jonathan King, which I'll tell you after we finish recording.
I can't wait.
Page 19, Penny picks the new pops. And it's Penny Valentine's singles reviews. And as you say, she's a brilliant writer. Yeah.
I really love, I mean, because as we've discussed, hardly anything here was a hit. So, and I went on YouTube and played almost every single record in this list and really enjoyed myself. But yeah, talking about Penny Valentine's writing, great review of Mr. Zero by Keith Relf. I'm very fond of dear Keith Relf with his starved face, which is the kind of thing you just expect to see in a 90s music paper.
Yeah.
She stands out in a different way to the other writers here. What I like is it's opinionated. It's actually her opinions rather than a kind of standard bland, should be a hit. Yeah. Quite rude about a few records. Yeah, there's just fascinating records here. There's them, Van Morrison's band, doing Richard Corey. Of course, Paul Simon's song, best known to many Beatles fans as Denny Lane's song on Wings Over America. Mm. There's Scott Engel and John Stewart of the Walker Brothers. I only came to dance with you, and I went down a rabbit hole with that one because it turns out there are two versions of this song, and it's just one is good and one is not. That was fun.
Ah, so you don't know which one she's talking about here, then?
Well, I do, boringly, because the one on Capitol is supposed to be not very good. The original American version is pretty good.
Mm.
And there's a Bob Lynn single, just in case we haven't had enough of Bob Lynn by this point in the magazine.
But also, yeah, just hidden away, just another single released this week, Percy Sledge, When a Man Loves a Woman.
Which she says is the sexiest record for a long time.
Yeah.
We use the word sexy. She absolutely goes mad for it, as we said. The parts where his voice collides beautifully with the organ and drum backing makes my knees go wobbly. This is going to be a huge, huge, gigantic smash hit. So, yeah, amazing.
One I did want to look at, actually, Julie Driscoll. I didn't want to have to do it. Gorgeous, clear-voiced Julie gently drifts through this super-duper loving Spoonful song beautifully. Really, I never thought I could listen to anyone but John Sebastian sing this, but this is a very, very attractive record. And it is. It's brilliant.
Didn't want to have to do it. Didn't want to have to break your heart. Didn't want to have to do it. I kept a hoping from the very start, but you kept on a trying, and I knew that you'd end up a crying, and I knew I didn't want to have to do it at all.
so much Loving Spoonful in here. They seem to have, while the Beatles are away, the Loving Spoonful will play. But it's a brilliant song. The B-side, Don't Do It No More, is also really good. But I found a thing, Brian Auger, because it's available to stream on an album called Julie Driscoll and Brian Auger, London, 1964-67. And on the sleeve notes, Brian Auger says, I didn't want to have to do it. A John Sebastian number, I'd heard the Loving Spoonful perform on stage in America, and on which Julie sings all three vocal parts, no mean feat. But I was thinking, I've got to get this, because I've got it on streaming. And if you have a look online, Brian Auger and Julie Driscoll albums are like a minimum of £150, £200. They're so expensive.
Gosh.
And I'm a huge Julie Driscoll fan, so I won't be buying those.
I will check that one out.
Today's Wednesday, today's Wednesday, Wednesday's roast beef, Tuesday soup, Monday is washing day, is everybody happy? You bet your life we are. Today's Thursday, today's Thursday, Thursday is shepherd's pie, Wednesday's roast beef, Tuesday's soup.
I was also noticing in Quick Spins, resting is the scaffold's 2 days Monday, and I have a story about that.
Yes.
See, I love the scaffold, but I've met Mike McCartney on several occasions. I was unaware of the significance of this song, because many years ago I'd been on an event and somebody was talking about football chants. And I'm fascinated by football chants, how they're made up. You know, do they arise from nowhere? Does someone decide? Is there a committee? And somebody said they'd been standing next to someone at a Sheffield Wednesday match who'd been trying to get a chant going. And this is the chant. Monday's washing day, Tuesday's shopping day, Wednesday, our shit. And I think there was a pause and his mate said, that is terrible. And I just always assumed that I thought it was quite catchy. So when I didn't know that it was based on the scaffold Mondays, shopping day, Tuesdays, wasn't it? So that was nice. That's my story about the 2 days Monday by the scaffold. Yeah. It is the only story about that song in the world, though.
I bet. There's a tiny other thing on Quick Spins, and you talk about going down deep dives. I went ridiculous places with this. It's Paddy, Klaus and Gibson are such a good-looking threesome. I've never understood why they didn't clinch it by making good records. Quick, Before They Catch Us, apart from sounding like the Dave Clark Five, is the theme music from a TV serial, so it will get the plays. This is on Pi Records. So basically, I know the story, but I wanted to get a few more details. But basically, they formed together the previous era. It was essentially Liverpool supergroup.
Mm.
Anybody who's listened to this episode we did on Merseybeat magazine with Mark Lewison might recognise some of these. So guitarist Paddy Chambers, he'd previously been a member of Steve and the Syndicate, Farron's Flamingos, The Big Three, and briefly with King Size Taylor and the Dominoes. And this is when he met King Size's drummer Gibson Kemp. And he'd previously played with Rory Storm and the Hurricanes. In fact, it was him who replaced Ringo Starr after he left them to join the Beatles. And while they were in Hamburg, they decided to form a proto-jazz group called The Eyes, with a third member, Lewis Collins, from The Professionals. Lewis Collins quit, obviously, to concentrate on his acting career, and he was then replaced by Klaus Voormann on bass, and that was Paddy, Klaus and Gibson. John Lennon saw them playing at the Pickwick Club in London, obviously being a bit biased because Klaus was his mate. He then enthused to Brian Epstein about them, so Brian signed them up and got them a deal with Pi Records. But unfortunately, Brian had a massive crush on Paddy Chambers, and this obviously caused tensions. And Paddy later said, it was obvious that Brian was getting emotionally hung up on me, and I tried my best to cope with it. In fact, I ended up in bed with him. But after about 5 minutes, I said, Brian, I just can't do this. And I got up and walked out. So they're probably possibly pushed by the general poor reviews the trio received. 2 months later, Klaus had not only quit and joined Manfred Mann, but also designed the album cover for Revolver. So, you know, we all know about Klaus Voormann. But as for Paddy Chambers, he teamed up with another Liverpool singer and generally regarded the best female Liverpool singer, sorry, Cilla, Beryl Marsden, and they formed a band called Sinbad. And he eventually went on to manage a number of local Liverpool bands. But here's where I went down the dive. Gibson Kent. So the following year, he married legendary photographer and Stewart's ex, Astrid, and later worked as a record executive for PolyGram until he retired and became an owner of a pub in Hamburg called Kemp's English Pub, which is still there today. And it's covered in Liverpool and Beatles memorabilia with live music. So if you're in Hamburg, go and pay a visit. And
Amazing.
And I went as far as, here's a TripAdvisor review for Kemp's English Pub. It's all relevant. I went there hoping to see a football match on Thursday night, and fortunately it wasn't on. Instead, I saw a brilliant Irish singer-guitarist, Stephen Kavanagh. I returned two nights later, had a perfect curry and a few beers. You don't become local in this pub, you become part of a family. The Beatles and other memorabilia is excellent. Tina is a fountain of knowledge on the Beatles and that period of history in Hamburg, and is a beautiful singer. Matthias is a wonderful host, definitely a must. Point to note, cash only. So, if you're listening, Kemp's Bar, I'm available for sponsorship.
Let's go there. Let's have a workouting. Down at the bottom, there's always down at the bottom, in quick spins at the end of the column, is Olivia Newton-John's debut single, Till You Say You'll Be Mine. And Penny's review is great. Olivia Newton-John, to name but a few, because she's got two names, you see. Olivia Newton-John sounds as though she made Till You Say You'll Be Mine in her front room.
Blimey.
You know, the beginning of a long and extraordinary career, to be honest.
Yeah.
Quite a bizarre career with, like, Banks of the Ohio, and recording with Cliff, and then essentially being incredibly famous for being sprayed black from the waist down in Greece. And also, Let's Get Physical. So, yeah. You just say, what a short time. At the time, we wouldn't have thought so, but what a short time, 11 years, is that she goes from banging away in her front room on this kind of nothing pop song, really, to disco fame.
Well, it's, I wonder if this review had an impact, because... this was a Jackie DeShannon song, and apparently it was recorded in the UK after Olivia won the Australian TV talent show Sing Sing Sing.
Oh, I see.
And it failed to chart in the UK anywhere, and the reviews were universally awful. Such was the fact that she wouldn't release another single until 5 years later with Dylan's If Not For You. But I don't know if it's because of the reviews, or I hope not.
Well... one thing we can, if she'd won a talent contest and come over, we can speculate that is a classic sort of like, oh shit, she's here. What do we do? You know, because winning a talent contest in Australia may have meant a lot there, but when she arrives here, it's like, oh great, someone, here's a talent contest winner.
Yeah.
And also, well played for a comeback, because yeah, If Not For You is a great choice of cover.
Yes.
And she was very talented, we have to say that as well.
I was in the Olivia Newton-John fan club as a kid. And wow. I don't think it was the official one, because I forget what I paid, but I got a so-called signed photo, but the photo was so blurred and the signature was so blurred that you couldn't make out her name, and I'm not actually sure it was her.
That'd be hilarious if they sent you a picture of Clodagh Rodgers. Of course, it was law that everyone had to call her Olivia Neutron Bomb.
Wasn't that Kenny Everett? I think started that, I think.
Oh, God.
Can't remember.
This probably isn't the place to say it, but, and he has gone, but I hated Kenny.
Oh, no, really?
Not as a person, but I just never found him. I think it's the thing, because I didn't grow up anywhere near London. It was like, for me, when I came to London, it was like people talked about Capital Radio and Kenny Everett, and I thought, oh, well, I'd better investigate these things, and found them wanting.
No, I grew up with Kenny. I used to phone him up. In fact, I won.
Oh, right.
I won a phone.
Oh, God, I picked the right person to tell. In fact, he's here now. Kenny, why haven't you released any records in the last 6 months?
I see. Are you still running up for the Beatles now?
Well, I don't know. I mean, we've got different scenes going. I don't know who's more popular in what part of the world. I don't know. I don't sort of worry about that.
How's your popularity in Europe at this moment?
Very good, I think. Very healthy.
Would you know why England became the pop centre?
It just happened that England had the right type of sound, and the right sort of visual image that the kids over the world wanted at that particular time. It just happened. It could have been anywhere. It could have happened. It could have been France. It could have, you know, it just happened to be England.
And on the back page, Stone Brian hits at latest smear on stars. Riff Raff? Oh, who cares? Says Brian Jones. Last week, a prominent national newspaper columnist made a blistering attack on pop singers by criticising them for the way they live their lives. The Daily Telegraph's Peter Simple, who was having a go at Minister of Defence, Mr. Dennis Healey, wound up by referring to such undesirable riffraff as pop singers. They are admired for living as ostentatiously as they please. And it's, yeah, reactions.
Well, there are two things here. One, this is the full-on generation gap that was really real. That people really did think, the Rolling Stones, who now look like models to us, people really did think they were gutter creatures who were defecating on our women. Oh, sorry, I didn't quite mean it to come out that way. But who were relieving themselves on petrol stations and running off with ladies and so forth. You could cut that. Don't drink any water now. But yeah, the other thing to say about this is that it refers to Peter Simple as a journalist. And as an old man who read the Telegraph, Peter Simple was a columnist. And I'm not even sure he was a real person, and I mean that literally. He was like a character like Beachcomber. And it was a really miserable, vile, conservative column. It was, like it suggests, reactionary. You know, he probably said the same thing about Beethoven.
Mm.
So it was interesting. It was a kind of deliberate, and I find it hilarious that this attack on the Rolling Stones comes in, quotes, Peter Simple was having a go at the Minister of Defence, Dennis Healey.
Mm.
Which, this is a classic case of shoehorning. If you're having a go at the Minister of Defence and you manage to get the Rolling Stones into it.
Yeah. Is he like a Henry Roots kind of thing?
It's more like a sort of a parody of a squire.
Yeah.
It was a sort of self-parody. It was a parody of an Evelyn Waugh type figure, if memory serves me right. I would have to look it up. But
with Brian Jones' reaction, it just doesn't bother me. Rolls off my back. Anyway, if some of the public do think this way, there's always the other part that doesn't. I suppose I'm scruffy and dirty. The difference is that I'll admit it now, whereas I wouldn't 3 or 4 years ago.
But it's interesting that he says things like, don't worry about conventional society, which if somebody said nowadays, you'd be like, oh yeah, whatever. But it would have been genuinely worrying to parents, and quite right too, given Brian Jones's proclivities. And he says, I don't give a damn what people think. I'd rather be labelled riffraff. It was just a massive contrast to 3 years ago when the Beatles had to, you know, get on the revolving podium at the Palladium and bow to the Queen.
Mm.
And again, we notice the attitude of disco music echo. It's a hard life earning a living as a pop star. And some artists manage to make money. Good luck to them.
Yes.
If you're a teenager, buying a magazine that takes the pop singer's side, it's quite refreshing because apart from the Beatles, the mainstream media would have been pretty much down on all this.
Wonderful Egg Pod Express. So that was Disc and Music Echo. What happened in 1972, Disc and Music Echo reverted back to the name Disc, but just 3 years later in August 1975, it emerged with Record Mirror and ceased publication. Yeah.
So it's still, because Art Record Mirror became RM and lasted a long time.
Mm.
It became the home of the dance chart. It used to do a chart with the BPMs of records on.
Yes. So among the tributes for its closure in 75, there were messages from Mark Bolan and Sir Paul McCartney.
Gosh. So I've just looked up Penny Valentine, who sadly died in 2003, but I am delighted to see that in 1965 she recorded the novelty single I Want to Kiss Ringo Goodbye.
Gotta hear that.
Yes, I'm sorry I interrupted you talking about the demise of disc and music.
That's fine. So, thank you, David. Overall, what does this magazine mean to you in terms of history, really?
I mean, I really loved reading it because it was an unmediated look at, ungatekeepered, as we say. It was, you know, a raw look at what 60s pop was like. I heard a lot of records I'd never heard by bands I'd never heard of. I was genuinely delighted by the literacy, it sounds stupid, but the intelligence of the writing, that it wasn't a kind of, gee, pop kids, Mick Jagger's got a new hat level of writing. It was something I would definitely have bought had I been more than 5 years old at the time. So I really enjoyed that. And yes, I'm really sorry about the late Jim Reeves.
So thanks to Susie Humphrey for the jingles, and to read this issue of Disco Music Echo, the magazine's online at iamtheeggpod.com, where you'll also find an exclusive playlist of this week's top 30 singles. To support this podcast and to access bonus content, please subscribe to patreon.com/eggpod. But for now, thank you so much, David Quantick.
Thank you, Chris. I really enjoyed that.